Okay, this is continuing with David Hogg on 14th August 1981. So he had this residual.
Right. Well, Ed Ohm is not the kind of fellow who would ever publish anything and give, especially giving error estimates, if he wasn't darn good and sure that that's the way it was. Mm-hmm. And so you can just look at the article yourself, yeah, and right. you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Very careful engineer.
Is he still at Bell Labs?
Yes, he is. He's at Homedale still. Yeah. Made a lot of good contributions to the waveguide art. There's a thing called the Ohm coupler, for example. It's a very widely used polarization mm-hmm. coupler. Excellent engineer. Okay, so that all went through and was published. Now, the next step then was the active satellite Telstar. And things were sort of taken out of the hands of the research people at that time. In a way, it was too big a job for us at Homedale to even think of building a satellite, although we contributed to the satellite antenna and so on, mm-hmm. Telstar. This was given to a group was formed up at Murray Hill under a fellow named Gene O'Neill and a man named Welber, Urban Welber, was involved to a great extent in that. So they did mainly the satellite kind of thing. And here again, it was decided to put up the large Earth stations then, one up at Andover, one at Plumer Bideau in France, and the British were building their own at Goonhilly.
Right.
And, okay, so there again, Derek Scoville and his group, another microwave maser, if you please.
Yes.
And they indeed did build one at 4 gigahertz, which, because the plan was to transmit up to Telstar at 6 gigahertz and down at 4, which are both in the low atmospheric noise bands. Mm-hmm. He indeed did build one, and we checked out the antenna again at 4 gigahertz. Actually, Bob Wilson got in on the latter part of that.
This is the same antenna.
This now is the 20-foot horn, because we planned also, in addition, for example, if the French were transmitting up, it would be received at Goonhilly, or Andover, up in Maine, on the main AT&T antenna, so to speak. But we, at the experimental station, we also wanted to receive that overseas transmission. Mm-hmm. And so Derek Scoville did deliver us a 4 gigahertz maser, and in fact the job of putting together that receiver and checking out the antenna and so on, that was mine. I was the one who did that, along with Ralph Semplek, who was my technical aide. So we did that, and again, of course, measured, did tipping curves at 4 gigahertz and so on, and it's the same old result. And that, in fact, is published in the BSTJ as part of Bill Jake's article on the receiving system
for Telstar.
At Crawford Hill for Telstar.
J-A-K-E, is that?
J-A-K-E-S, yeah.
Jake's.
Bill Jake's, he was the overall project engineer for Homedale on mm-hmm. the job. And those numbers are in there, and you just add them up, and you come again. You're a couple of degrees shy.
Now, in retrospect, you can see what was happening. Were you getting suspicious at all?
Oh yes, we were always wondering, you know, where that could be, but no one had any plausible explanation. Because it had happened then three times. You see,
right.
Three times that there's some problem there, and no one could figure out where that was.
And I suppose most attention was being focused towards some mismeasurement of a component as opposed to some astronomical
phenomenon. Yes, and of course the troposphere sort of thing was somewhat suspect, but you know, we had measured that at three different frequencies, and John Shakeshaft had measured it, and everything was fine, so we really couldn't blame that. So it was a mystery.
Yeah.
And so then the whole Telstar job was accomplished very successfully, and in fact, at Crawford Hill, Scoville and I were in the cab of that antenna, and we were the first ones to receive overseas broadband transmission.
Mm-hmm. Via Telstar, yeah.
Via Telstar, mm-hmm. That came from France. And that was sort of an exciting time.
Now, you wanted to be able to receive there just so you could study the signals yourself, not just rely on the Andover antenna?
That is correct. We wanted to demonstrate that it was the first time it had ever been done.
But that could have been done with just the Andover antenna. Could have demonstrated
it,
that too.
It could have. It yeah. could have, yes.
But you were just worried a bit of competition there.
Well, you might say a little bit of that. You know, okay. We wanted to demonstrate that indeed we could do that. So there we were, left with that, and as I say, I guess Bob Wilson came after that, and we started some additional work on the antenna, checking its gain and several sort of basic measurements like that.
What was the motivation for those?
Simply to demonstrate technique in that case. We used a source on a helicopter and got some extremely accurate measurements of the gain of that 20-foot horn reflector. We wanted to tie everything down as best we possibly could.
Was it at all motivated by this residual? Would it have been done?
Well, that was in a little bit in everyone's mind, you know, to just keep on plugging at this thing and see if something would turn up. Now, we, at that time, however, the lasers were invented, in particular the helium neon, the CO2, Patel came on the CO2 laser, helium xenon. And so, what I did then was to get into, and the question then was, would laser propagation be a useful kind of thing? So I got into that quite strongly at that time. And Arno, who had been working on OH, and indeed on the old antenna we'd used, the old 4-foot one we'd originally used, and so he and Bob then went ahead. It was decided that it would be a good thing to build a good cold load and tie down where this residual was. And indeed, that's what happened. And I remember keeping asking, you know, did you find that that bit of noise? And their numbers were coming up, of course, very similar to what had happened before.
Now, before you go any further, the OH was searching for the astronomical OH line? Or
yes.
Not atmospheric?
No, that was
the
right. Right. Arno was a radio astronomer from Columbia,
right.
and he was doing some radio astronomy there.
I knew he did that, but I forgot it was a horn that he used for an antenna.
Yes, it was the...
And now the other thing that I hadn't realized before is you're saying that Penzias and Wilson essentially were motivated to try to find this residual that had been lingering or now was... People were beginning to believe there.
Oh, yes, indeed. You know, when you do it three times and
It wasn't a matter that they did something and they found a residual
it was understood that was there.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, that was the primary motivation for them doing this experiment, you're saying?
I would say,
to
yes.
To pin it down.
Yes,
is it real? And if so,
yes.
What is it?
Where is that residual?
Yeah.
And of course, it had been seen at three separate frequencies,
right.
So there's no fooling.
And you say the improvement was that they had a cold load.
Oh, yes. Bob set up a good deal of the needed receiving equipment, and Arno built the cold load. Helium cool load, and very carefully, such that the temperature was known quite accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, what was done was to switch between the antenna and the cold load.
Right.
And in that way, residual was still there.
Right.
But it wasn't, really didn't understand what was going on until, as you probably heard the story, that Arno, Bernie Burke called him, or Arno called Bernie or something, and Arno said what they're doing, and so Bernie said, "Well, why don't you get in touch with Dickie or whoever?"
Who was actively building a system to
also had done the theory, and was saying there should be something there in microwave range.
Right.
So So that sort of wrapped it up, and the whole thing was settling.
You say that Bob Wilson worked on some aspects of the receiver, but it was already an existing very good receiver. I mean, was that,
yes,
that improved some more?
Well, no, there were certain things done. For example, that we, in just a communications experiment, we did not have a polarization coupler in there for a cold load or anything like that. So there were changes that had been made. And we used as a second stage a broadband traveling wave tube, you know, following the maser. Mm-hmm. And we went through and checked a lot of that stuff out. And,
I see.
Bob, of course, a very excellent electronics, so he...
So it was a, they were small modifications, but nevertheless they definitely improved the receiver.
Well,
it's not a rebuilding of the receiver.
No, they got the same result that Semplak and I did, really. Well, there's an interesting, a very interesting component that's used in that to do the switching. I don't know whether you know about what are called squeeze sections. What you do is take a piece of round waveguide, and you do this on your laboratory bench, and you squeeze the center part of that into, yes, an elliptical, and you squeeze it such that you get the desired phase shift through it, and then it just holds, and then you simply have to rotate the thing to 45 degrees, and then and it's essentially perfect match. There's hardly any mismatch and very low loss, and indeed that is the manual switch, really. One can use that, or you can rotate it around and do get a audio type signal, 100 cycles, 100 hertz or whatever. But that was a certainly part of that system. That,
yeah, you know, that's the part that Wilson worked on. Was
yes, I've forgotten whether Semplak and I had that already or not. Maybe we switched to a room temperature load or something. I've just forgotten what I said.
Well, that could be checked too.
Yeah, that's probably in there.
Now, another question is, before the contact with Burke and Dickey took place, can you recall how accurately this residual that they were getting had been determined? Or was it only the same kind of accuracy as before, and then once they had this motivation, they really...
No, as I say, the switch itself, switching arrangement was very... very low loss, but that really didn't matter because you're simply switching between the load and the antenna. And the question was, the load, Arno believed he knew that to very good accuracy, what its effective temperature was. The question then was, is there anything wrong with the antenna? Could that be a problem? And as I'd written memos many times showing that the contribution should only be most a couple of tenths of degrees from the radiation from the back from the Earth, and the resistive losses on the little feeding wave, or the feeding waveguide, that one could calculate to very good accuracy.
Yes.
So it just wasn't there. Even if you said, okay, there's a 1 Kelvin that we could attribute to the antenna, which is being extremely generous, we couldn't really see that it was there, you still had a residual.
Still had two more.
Still had two more, yeah.
But what I'm getting at is, from what you say before, but I clearly have to go back and look at these papers, it seems like it was, the residual was something like 2 or 3 times the error, and therefore something you wouldn't want to stick your neck out for tremendously. But through the improved load technique and perhaps some receiver improvements, had Penzias and Wilson gotten it down to where it was 5 or 10 times the errors, the residual?
Yes.
By the time that they heard about the whole Dickey thing.
Yes, they were quite confident that it certainly was there.
So
that it was of the order.
In other words, there was much more confidence than there had been in these 3 previous experiments.
Yes, the errors were less.
Right.
Because
and then, of course,
switching to the load.
Mm-hmm. And of course, once they had the motivation from the whole Dickey thing, then they undoubtedly
jumped
on it.
That's right. Then one had, a physical reason for saying, yes, it is there.
Yeah.
And whereas before, of course, we had no no idea that
shouldn't really give you more confidence, but I suppose it does. Yeah.
Well, you know, you have to have a raison d'être for such a, anything you measure, and but we did not publish our errors on the original 4 gigahertz on the Telstar receiver, although we I think they're quoted to half a breather. But Ed Ohm certainly did yeah. at 2300. And
I'll have to talk to him.
Yeah. Oh, he's quite a character. He's a great guy. A little thick-skinned, but he's very, very careful. Very careful.
Well, in closing, I'd like to ask one general question, and that is the rather striking thing that Bell Labs, which is hardly an astronomical observatory, of course, has been responsible for two of the most fundamental discoveries in radio astronomy. And I'd be interested in your opinion as to how this has come about.
Well, there's no question in my mind that it's the people of course at Bell Lab are extremely good. However, I think it's simply the technology. Now, I mentioned Harold Fries and his heterodyne receiver
before we started the recording.
Okay. And that, of course, was a great contribution.
That was 1928 or 9?
That was 1928. And Jansky, obviously, was the word enthralled, but fascinated by the whole heterodyne business, because you could really, really do things with it.
Right.
And so
the first superhet receiver?
No, I'm trying to remember who got the patent on it. I don't think Harold Fries got the patent on the first one. It wasn't Armstrong. He's the F fellow.
Yeah,
then
FM. FM. Right.
Someone like that.
Right.
Though,
but what was Fries's big improvement? I mean, just a very good quality.
Well, it had only been invented that year or something.
Mm-hmm.
His great intuition, he saw right away that, or maybe he'd only heard about it. I don't know whether it was even published. But he had that quality, that, mm-hmm. that the intuition, and he recognized something good, and so he went right ahead and built one.
Yes.
He saw the principle. And then, I'm sure the other engineers all built their own then, of course, and improved upon them. And that's why Jansky, because mm-hmm. he had a good instrument to work with. And
and
that's the same story, exactly the same story, regarding the solid-state maser, and the good high quality horn reflector antennas. It's exactly the same thing repeated itself.
Yeah.
Really,
and
really
and
good
great
technology.
Confidence in your instrument.
Oh yes,
knowing
yes
exactly
indeed.
What it's doing.
Yes indeed. Yes, yes. Oh yes. Scoville argued with me about this 1 degree or 2 degrees, or 1 degree that he had to add on to his maser number. He said, no, it's not right. It's 1 degree better than that. It's 11 degrees. It's not 12 or whatever
right.
the number was, you see. And, oh, yes, he is very confident, but finally broke down. I said, okay.
Well, okay. A related question is, you have the telephone company, which is obviously interested in communications research.
Right.
And yet Jansky's residual was of absolutely no practical importance in 1932, at least that's my assessment. Maybe you disagree with that.
Well,
and this 1 degree was certainly not of any importance, was it, in 1962?
Well,
or 2 or 3 degrees. Or am I wrong?
Well,
there?
Yeah, it is of some importance. So the you know, in all systems, you're looking for signal to noise ratio, of course, and. That was the same in both cases. You wanted to simply have a good signal-to-noise ratio when you finally did build your communication system.
Right. But there comes a point of limiting returns when it's not worth tracking down.
Oh, yeah, that becomes a matter of economics.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yes, yes, economics. Although, what happened with the first satellite communication systems, for example, they did use masers. You know, they used and then eventually things improved, the power from the satellite improved, and then you could go to parametric amplifiers and lesser quality amplifiers.
Right.
But back in the beginning, when you're first, you don't know whether things are going to work, then that's when you have to have good instruments. So, yeah, it's simply the technology of Bell Lab that brought about both of those things, I believe.
Yeah. Well, do you maybe you don't have never looked into it. Do you agree with my assessment that the small hiss that Jansky was getting was not of any practical importance for the radio telephone transatlantic circuit?
Well, you know, if you build a system now at VHF or HF, of course, the noise figure, the noise from your receivers are so much less than comes from the center of the galaxy.
But that wasn't true in 1932, I don't think.
That was not true then, but all I'm saying is that that discovery is now the limiting factor,
yes.
If you wish.
But that then means that a place like the telephone company has a 50-year outlook, though.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes.
Which is not the usual thing for a business firm.
No, that is true. That is true. Oh, yes. This is very...
Maybe I'm asking an institutional question. How is it that within a private business, this scientific laboratory has been set up, which is so far-looking, and they're willing to put a lot of money on something that ends up not paying off for 50 years.
Okay. Now, that can best be described by the millimeter wave work that is going on there now. In fact, I had quite a hand in designing the offset Cassegrain that they use, because
the 7-meter dish,
the 7-meter, yes, yeah. They wanted to go ahead and build one 7 or 10 meters in the usual paraboloid design, and I argued against that because two reasons. One is that with the design that they presently have, you don't have any blockage in the aperture, so you have very clean radiation patterns. And the second, and probably more important, is that the match is good looking into that. In other words, you get nothing bounced back toward your receiver, which gives rise, according to Bob, to the baseline wander that is extremely annoying.
Ripples,
all that kind of thing from the long distance out there and back. And this, of course, doesn't return anything to you, so you have... So
now, how is this relevant to what I asked you? I was asking about the long-term outlook.
Yes, right. And so one proceeds, therefore, with millimeter waves, for example, using quasi-optical techniques. Now, what I'm getting at is that if you have that kind of activity going on, you attract good people who are used to working, say, in that wave, millimeter wave range, sub-millimeter wave. You develop new techniques that are useful to the overall cause, if you wish.
Yes.
So it is not a far-flung sort of thing, really, when you get right down to it, because you're developing new techniques. Well, the antenna, for example, which was really built for, we got the money for that under the guise of satellite communications, because at that time I had argued, and indeed they did put in the Comstar satellites two extremely fine beacons at 20 and 30 gigahertz. And the reason they were put in there is because those are roughly 20 and 30. Those are for the new communication bands, which are 2 gigahertz wide at those frequencies. Mm-hmm. And we had to do fundamental propagation studies. And the antenna there was used for that, as well as for millimeter wave radio astronomy. So it all ties together.
Is this a fair summary of what you're saying, is that in order to get the attract the best people, and in order to get some useful techniques developed,
I'll take it.
You have to let them work on some scientific things that themselves don't matter to the telephone company, but in the process, because the people are there and they develop techniques which turn out to be useful.
Yes, and you need, of course, if you're doing good millimeter wave radio astronomy, you need some excellent instruments, and the components that go into those things have to be good quality. And you know, if you're smart enough, you invent something new, a new design, and that goes into it. And so,
what you're saying though is that in practice it turns out to be very difficult to design these
excellent millimeter components unless you let the person play around with radio astronomy.
That is correct.
This is what I'm getting at.
Everyone has to have a goal and to get their adrenaline up, and if they have need for something like that, then they will either they will invent it and build it and put it into their system.
Right.
And that's fine.
But, I mean, Bell Labs' experience has been that this is a more efficient way to do it than just to tell them, we need a sensitive millimeter receiver for satellite communications. That doesn't get you the same kind of person.
That is right. That normally does not. You have to do it in a particular way. Now, in the development and engineering groups, you have to do what you just said sometimes, but it's not as effective.
Yeah.
Not as effective.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, okay.
That ends the interview with David C. Hogg on 14 August 1981.